Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, April 8th, 2013 will come to order. Senator Sieben, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
you look surprisingly fresh, but I don't know anything about this stuff, so.
Well, I'm happy to work on educating you on this, so.
No, I don't, that's okay.
Okay, it can be as short as you'd like.
That's why us guys leave a few women to do this stuff, so.
Oh, I thought you were talking about my bill, Mr. Chairman. No.
You can educate me on the bill now. Go ahead. Senate File 785.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 785 is an appropriation for the Minnesota. It's for coming out of the Environmental Fund to go to the Pollution Control Agency to be transferred to the Commissioner of Health to continue PFC monitoring in the East Metropolitan areas. That was kind of a mouthful of a sentence, so I'll try to back up a bit. The 3M company manufactured a group of chemicals called perfluorinated chemicals at its Cottage Grove manufacturing facility from the 1950s until 2000, when the company announced it was phasing out two PFCs, PFOA and PFOS. And during the time of the manufacturing, the company disposed of PFC waste at several locations in Washington County, including the 3M Oakdale disposal site, a Woodbury disposal site, and the Cottage Grove disposal site, as well as the Washington County landfill. And what was found later on was that these chemicals leached into the drinking water. 3M also discharged wastewater containing high levels of PFCs directly into the Mississippi River. PFCs are bioaccumulative, they're persistent in the environment, and they're extremely mobile. Subsequent, starting in the about 7 years ago or so, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health began to establish a plan or track how to accommodate the PFC pollution that had taken place in the East Metro area. So in 07, the Department of Health issued a special well construction advisory, which remains in effect for a 12-square-mile area in Washington County. The advisory places limits on installation and operation of new groundwater wells, and there by the Department of Health right now, there's a drinking well advisory and health-based values for two different types of PFCs. And there are still right now 83 homes in the area that are provided water filters or bottled water because of PFC contamination that exceeds the health-based values established by the Department of Health. So a few years back, then, to start to try to understand the impact that PFCs have on human health and on particularly the amount of exposure to people in the East Metropolitan area, which, as I said, because it was located in the drinking water, was higher than the state average or certainly the national average, national levels. There was a environmental health tracking program established at the Department of Health. And what this appropriation would do is to continue to fund the PFC portion of that environmental health tracking and biomonitoring program. And so I'm happy to go into the description more. With me today is Gene Johnson from the Department of Health, who can do a better job explaining of it than I can. But for the members, I just point out that this PFC pollution has struck areas of that I represent particularly hard, and that it's been a source of angst and concern for residents of my area, where they know now and are used to the idea that there's PFCs in the drinking water. The wells in the area are obviously below the health-based values established by the Department of Health, but they're still exposed to PFCs in the drinking water. Ms. Johnson can talk more about how the biomonitoring program worked but this has been especially effective at targeting residents who have private wells, where their levels may have been even higher than some of the public drinking water supplies. So with that, perhaps Ms. Johnson could provide more clarity on the program.
Oh, that was pretty good. Ms. Johnson, go ahead. Please just say your name for the record, too, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jean Johnson. I am an epidemiologist at the Minnesota Department of Health. In our chronic disease and environmental epidemiology section. And I also direct our environmental health tracking and biomonitoring program. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you, but I'm just wondering what the buzzing is. I don't, someone's got something on, but I don't know what it is. It's not you.
We went through this, Mr. Chair, we went through this last Thursday, the same buzzing, same
thing.
Yeah,
I blamed Weber, and it wasn't his fault. And
no, they eventually fixed it. I saw him digging around in that room back there.
I remember that, yeah. I don't know. And then the microphones were coming in way better, too, afterwards, you remember?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so anyway, go ahead, Dr. Johnson. Okay. We'll get through the buzzing somehow.
All right. Well, as I said, I've been directing the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program since it was established in 2007, as Senator Sieben described, and this is a program at the Health Department specifically to do, several things. Biomonitoring means measuring chemicals in people. So just as we measure chemicals in soil or groundwater, we're really talking here about measuring it in human specimens, so typically blood and urine is where we what we do with biomonitoring. And it's something that's been work that's been going on at the CDC for many years in their public health laboratory, and it's something that we've been developing just over the last 5 to 10 years here at the Minnesota Department of Health. Our laboratory's been developing this capacity, and with this program since 2007, we've also greatly increased our capacity to do this kind of work. As Senator Sieben described, the issue in the East Metro area with the perfluorochemicals certainly was one of the...
Dr. Johnson, can you go back to the blood and urine testing? How does this happen? Does somebody go to the clinic and get tested, or they come to see you, or how does this actually work where you end up having blood and urine tests?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with each of our projects, it starts with a study design or a plan that we work on at the Health Department where we identify who the population of concern is that we are wanting to test and look at. And then once that's all been decided and approved, we also have a scientific advisory panel that reviews all the protocols and the plans.
So you get a bunch of people to volunteer?
And then they're recruited, right, they're identified and then they're recruited, yes. But it is voluntary.
Keep going. Maybe you'll answer all my questions when you if I listen longer. Go ahead.
So continuing, yes, I'll just describe the PFC project in particular. What we did there, we identified the East Metro area, specifically the community living in Oakdale because of the contamination to the municipal water there, as well as we had over 150 homes with private wells contaminated above the drinking water standard. That was the other group that we identified for biomonitoring. And then from those two groups, the bill specified that we were to do 100 people each in two communities. Those were the two communities we selected. So from those two groups, we actually randomly selected 100 individuals from households with contaminated drinking water. And those folks were invited to participate in the biomonitoring program. If they agreed, if they gave consent, it was done with informed consent, they were invited to come to a local clinic in the East Metro area where a blood sample was collected, and it was then taken to our public health laboratory where it was analyzed for 7 different perfluorinated chemical compounds. What we found in the first round of testing that was done in 2008, we found elevated perfluorochemicals in both communities, both the Oakdale Municipal Community as well as the private well community folks. They were from Lake Elmo and Cottage Grove. Their levels were elevated above what is normally seen in the U.S. population. Something important to know about PFCs, they're found in 98% of the U.S. population. They're very common, but they were elevated in this community that had the drinking water exposure. And this was what we would have expected to see. When we presented this to our scientific advisory panel, their recommendation was that we should go back in 2 years and repeat the test because what they anticipated is that over time, with these chemicals being phased out of production and also with the water treatment in place, that the levels in people should be going down. And so they recommended we go back and retest, and we did that again in 2008. We went back to 164 of the original 196 people that we tested, and we did find that, in fact, PFC levels in their blood had declined by, on average, about 20% to 25% overall. However, their levels are still elevated above U.S. national levels. So most recently, our advisory panel looked at this issue again just this last year. They recommended that there should be a third round just to, again, provide assurance to the community that the levels are coming down. And also they recommended expanding to include newer members of the community, people who may have moved into the area more recently who would not have had the opportunity to be tested before. So I think with that, I will answer any questions that you have.
What did we do about the contaminated water?
Mr. Chair, the water is being treated by the Pollution Control Agency in areas like Oakdale where there is elevated levels, where the levels exceeded the health-based values. Or in the case of private drinking wells, then the Pollution Control Agency provides either filters or bottled water to individual homes and residents, and they're still doing that.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Senator and Doctor, for the testimony. A couple questions come out of this, seems to me. This 3M is, have they been working with the group at all over the years? And the other question that comes up is, if there's contaminated water, how can someone move into the area? How could someone get a permit to even build and or live in a particular area if these levels were as high as they are? I would think that if I was the lending agency, I'd have some big questions about that, especially if I'm going to be holding the mortgage. And I guess, again, the first question is, how cooperative has 3M been over the years? Are they supplying the water for their decontaminated areas, or their contaminated areas, excuse me? And how would they go about getting a permit in a contaminated area like that?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'll take a stab at that because Dr. Johnson works in the Department of Health on this particular program. But just digging back into my brain now, first, I would say that 3M has been working with the state on the broader PFC issue. There's now currently a lawsuit between the Attorney General is suing the 3M company. It was in the paper just yesterday, I think it was, over the contamination of the natural resources that occurred as a result of the PFCs being disposed of. That's kind of a separate issue, though, from the actual drinking water. It's still related to the PFC issue. But 3M, when we established this program back in 2007, 3M certainly was a very active and engaged partner. I don't know if partner is the right word. They were certainly an active participant in lobbying, working with me and with others, Representative Bunn at the time, to come up with the parameters of the bill that established the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. For instance, there are industry representatives that now sit on the advisory council for the program that we're discussing today. And with regards to disclosure from agents, this issue arose several years back, but local members of the community who at the time encouraged me not to stop talking about it because they thought that it would decrease housing values. They were concerned about the impact it would have on housing stock in the areas in Cottage Grove, for instance. I always felt that it's better to be upfront with the constituents and to try to gain the scientific knowledge that they can. And what we found is, you know, for instance, all of Cottage Grove's public water supply is below the health-based values that the Department of Health recommends for PFCs. So the municipal water supply in Cottage Grove right now is perfectly fine. It's below the levels. It's some of the wells in the more rural parts of Cottage Grove that are of concern. And obviously, there have been a lot of community meetings over the years, and residents generally want this information so that they can make informed decisions about whether to continue to use bottled water, for instance, or have filters on their own homes. It's not required to be disclosed in a real estate transaction, though. I'm not exactly sure why, but that, to my best of my understanding, it's not required to be disclosed.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair. Senator, the question still, I guess, kind of sticks in my mind here, is the finger, you know, and I'm going to be fairly new to this because I'm not from the area, but it seems to me that 3M is a pretty big company that would step up to their responsibilities and liabilities, but apparently that's not happened if they're not paying for these. I mean, has there been something determined that 3M is the cause of this? And if that were the case, wouldn't they be paying for the study? Wouldn't they be paying for the bottled water situation? Or, you know, that's really the only other question I have.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I didn't answer that very well because I missed saying that in 07, in 2007, the state and the PCA reached a consent order. Or, I'm sorry, the PCA and 3M reached a consent order, and there were parameters of that agreement that included what 3M had to do to remediate some of the pollution that took place. That consent agreement did not include any compensation to the state for degradation of natural resources, and that is why there's this separate lawsuit that's taking place right now. But for instance, and I don't represent Oakdale or Lake Elmo, but I know that 3M, because the PFC exposure did exceed health-based values, they were, as part of that consent order, they were paying the Pollution Control Agency for the cost of remediating the water in, I believe, Lake Elmo and Oakdale. Could have just been Lake Elmo. So there was this larger consent agreement that was reached in 2007 that did account for some of the costs that were incurred. I believe, and maybe Mr. Knopf remembers, I believe, too, that there was $1 million that was set aside that 3M contributed to the state to help offset costs of studies that were to take place and things like that. And obviously that money has been used up now.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Doctor, what are you going to do with the results once you get them? And I'm just curious. This is the third round of testing now? So we went through something similar with mesothelioma on the Iron Range, and so I understand what's kind of going on here, but once you get the results of this third round of testing, is it the intent to use them in some way to benefit the people that live there, or what are we going to do here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. I mean, one of the things that we try to do with these projects is make sure that they do provide a benefit to the community. And in fact, the legislation specifically directs us to work with the community members.
They're cheering for you, so just so you know.
Okay, I'll think of it that way. So we are actually right now planning a meeting for later this spring to work with them on some of the most recent results of an analysis of some questionnaire data that we collected, looking at what sources might be contributing to their blood exposure. And so that's what we would do again with this third round is go to the community with a community meeting, provide the results back to the participants. Some of them choose to share that information with their physician if they need any sort of advice in terms of any health concerns they have. And then we make that community report available to the community, to public health officials, so that can guide any decision making that they have to do as far as whether there's any additional work that needs to be done.
And it's the consensus of the department that we don't have enough information after two rounds of studies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the advisory panel's feeling was that this would provide additional assurance that these levels continue to decline, that's what we expect to occur, but they felt that by actually measuring it, you know, we would be able to say that definitely this is what's occurring, levels are approaching sort of more background national levels. So this is added assurance for the community that it's going in the direction we think it's going in and that we anticipate it will go in.
Mr. Chair, I'd just add that PFCs are what's called an emerging contaminant, and the way I understand it is that there's, especially in 2007 when the exposure was sort of in the spotlight, there wasn't a lot known about the impacts that PFCs had on human health, and as there's been more studies across the nation, there was a particularly large exposure in West Virginia, and some studies have since come out of there, that these levels then that are measured here can be compared to other large exposure, other populations that had similar levels of exposure, and then the health impacts can be studied and looked at in comparison to studies that have come out in recent years now, too. So that's an additional reason why I think that this is a good use of this environmental fund money.
Hey, Senator Sieben, would you rather have this in the omnibus bill or go on its own?
I think the omnibus bill, if you're putting together a good bill, Mr. Chairman.
You want to gamble? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
One more quick question, if I could. So 3M donated $1 million, Senator Sieben, in 2007, so that equates out to a lot less than 313. Did you say that the state had put some dollars towards the organization and the development of the environmental health tracking? I forget what the figure you said that the state had done.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the state has funded this through the environmental fund in the past. I wouldn't say that 3M donated the money either. It was a consent order that was reached with the PCA and 3M to avoid further lawsuits that would likely occur. But right, there has been money appropriated for this program in the past.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, thank you, Senator Sieben. We'll leave Senate File 785 over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Members.
Senator Torres-Ray. Senate File 517. Welcome to the committee, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. I am delighted to be here before your committee presenting Senate File 517, and I very much hope that we are able to support this bill, Mr. Chairman and members. This is an issue that we've talked about over the years, and my intent here is to really help the state solve an issue that has been really problematic for us for a number of years, in a sense that we provide funding to the schools out of this trust fund that sometimes we're not able to kind of maximize the resources that we need for the schools out of these lands. So Senate File 517 appropriates money for acquisition of school trust land by the Department of Natural Resources. And the issue, members, as you many of you know, is that we really our duty here is to really look at how do we have ongoing support for our schools, but also protect our environment. And so our proposal, although is modest, Mr. Chairman, we are hoping that you can dedicate $5 million is the proposal that we are asking to start with. And it will help us really resolve a longstanding conflict that we have again and again, you know, not being able to really have a clear perspective of how much money will be coming from these lands and how it will be dedicated to the school. So this will give us a better sense of, you know, how we can allocate the money and in a more sustainable way. And the recommendation, Mr. Chairman, as I said, is $5 million, $2.5 million a year. And this is before you, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that you have letters from multiple organizations, both environmental and in education, that support this effort. And with me, I have two gentlemen that will like to explain a little bit more, you know, how this will work. And we also have some staff here to respond to questions that you may have.
Senator Torres-Ray, so you want $5 million put in the blank spaces on the bill? Is that what?
With your support, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's with my support, but you can have the $5 million put in there because it's not in there yet. So Senator Ehr moves that on line 1.7 after the dollar sign, and after on line 1.22 after the dollar sign, insert $5 million. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion adopted. Okay. Go ahead with your witnesses now. And say your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is Don Arnosti. I represent Audubon, Minnesota members across the state. We're very pleased here to testify in support of Senate File 517 today. This is a bill that attempts to offer one solution to a longstanding conflict that the state of Minnesota has had. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, the school trust lands go back in history to the beginnings of the state when the federal government granted to Minnesota, as well as many other states across the nation, Section 16 and Section 36 of most townships in order to provide for education, public education of school kids. This was done in the mid to late 1800s in several different grants. And a total of something approaching 8 million acres was granted to the state of Minnesota in this, on this, for this purpose. Most of those lands were sold off during those ensuing decades to settlers, often for $5 an acre, what I recall was a very common price. And many of our towns and communities across the state are situated on some of these sold-off trust lands. Approximately 2.5 million acres of trust lands were never sold. They are concentrated in north central and northeastern Minnesota. There are very large blocks in places like Coochiching County because the state was granted some further so-called swampland acts, which were basically lands that at the time nobody could figure out what to do with them. They were not attractive to settlement, and there were not resources that were readily exploitable. And the federal government just turned over some very large blocks. So the Red Lake Bog, for example, and much of Coochiching County came in further grants. The state has put those into the school trust land account, and the Department of Natural Resources has managed these 2.5 million acres of land for 100 years since the natural resources have been around. These lands are supposed to provide income to the permanent school fund, which is a small part of the school funding formula these days. I think it's something like $30 a pupil, approximately, is contributed out of the school fund across the state in perpetuity. Many of these lands, some of these lands are found right now at the bottom of iron ore pits and producing very significant revenues for the state when they are mined. Approximately half of our state forest land is school trust land, and on much of that state forest land, commercial timber harvest is appropriate and able to be accomplished. And those two sources between iron ore, taconite mining, and forest harvest, those are the two primary sources of revenue that have built up an approximately $700 or $800 million school trust fund. That's my recollection of what the fund is. Yes. There's legislation that was passed by the last legislature, signed into law by this governor, that the DNR is working on in order to tighten up the fiduciary management of these lands, to try to produce a clearer understanding of which of these lands are possible to generate revenue, which of them aren't, and perhaps what types of revenue. In other words, would it be lakeshore development? Would it be timber harvest? Would it be gravel mining? Would it be hard rock mineral mining or other types of systems? Also found on these lands are many high-value natural resources. For example, designated old-growth forest, undeveloped lakeshore, scientific and natural areas containing rare species, rare plants and animals, insects, things of that nature, native prairie, remnant prairie. Remember, these are already publicly owned lands, and so there's a potential conflict there between very high-value natural resources and the mandate and the requirement to produce revenue to put into the school funds for our kids. What this bill is about is one of a number of tools that can be used to resolve these conflicts. Current law and Natural Resource Commissioner policy states that when those two items come into conflict, high-value natural resources and the need to generate revenue, revenue will take precedence. And so, for example, the school trust land controls approximately 16 miles of undeveloped lakeshore on Lake Vermilion. There is public value to having undeveloped lakeshore. It provides fish spawning habitat, for example. If every inch of every lake were developed, fully developed with cabins and docks and lawns and things of that nature, we would not have the natural resources that people come to expect in our lakes. The question is it appropriate to sell off all 16 miles of that lakeshore to private development, or are there some areas that perhaps we'd like to retain those public natural resource values? Native prairies, the same thing, that we have less than 1% of the original native prairies in our state. There's, I believe, something like 7,000 acres of native prairie in public hands on wildlife management areas that could be sold to plant corn or to mine gravel on. The question is, do we want to impoverish our children by taking away the last remnants of native prairie, or perhaps could we use funding from a bill such as this to compensate the trust, put some money in the trust, and still retain the land and natural resource ownership, but allow those unique and special natural resource values to be the predominant management. We encourage you. I guess I'd like to draw your attention to the letter signed by a number of different organizations that's in your packet. And as Senator Torres Rey said, the Minnesota School Board Association as well has introduced a letter saying that they support this legislation, and we encourage you to support it as well. Very much.
You want to go next?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Chaplin. I'm a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. I'm also here because I'm a member of the Prairie Plan Working Group. That's a collaboration of 10 organizations and agencies that produce the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan. Now, the mission of the Nature Conservancy is to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends. And it's for that reason we support Senate File 517 to allow the DNR to acquire significant school trust lands for conservation purposes. Now, Mr. Arnasty already mentioned the fact that there are significant numbers of native prairie lands on school trust lands. In fact, actual number is about 7,331 acres of the 235,000 acres of native prairie we know continue to exist in Minnesota. And what we mean by native prairie is that's any land that any grassland that has never been plowed and retains most of the native plants that should occur in that area. Now, it's no accident that the school trust land supports so much native prairie, because if you think about it, when this land was set aside over 120 years ago, there was much more prairie around. And in many cases, that land has been used fairly lightly over the intervening time. And so that in many cases, these school trust lands truly are remnants of our prairie heritage. Similarly, there's over 290,000 acres of land of outstanding and high biodiversity significance. This is a category that the Minnesota County Biological Survey, when they have done their surveys, place on the best examples of natural communities across the state. So with those extremely valuable biological sense lands, we feel that they deserve continued management to maintain the biological and conservation values. And this could be lost if management were changed to a highest and best use standard instead of maintaining the biological and conservation values. And it's for this reason we support the buyout that gives the DNR the authority to buy out these to protect those native prairies and other natural resources. So we, in addition, urge you to include funds in the 2013 capital investment bill for this important conservation purpose. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to totally understand this acquisition through fee title, $5 million going to be given to the I think it says the DNR or Board of Soil and Water. The DNR obviously is going to have more land to manage. Have they been consulted at all as to what that's going to cost? No? Am I missing this thing here completely?
Yeah, because all of this land is currently managed by the DNR. It's in the school trust, and they manage it now for the conservation and biological purposes. If we were to change that standard, as is now required, to highest and best use, they would now be required to manage it for that highest and best use unless they buy out the rights, basically, from the school trust so that they can continue to manage it for the conservation purposes.
So the land is not being, obviously, financially, it's not good for the school trust. This $5 million is basically a funnel of money, if you will, and I'm going to say whether wrong or right, I'm just trying to better understand it, to our K-12 education system that was not there before, because that land was not being, there was no revenue other than forestry on some lands, I believe, and as Mr. Arnosti mentioned with regards to mineral mining, of course there would be some revenue when they're doing some mining. So this is a $5 million appropriation to the, basically to the K-12 education because of the land that's not being, I mean, it's just not generating any revenue.
Senator Torresby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think the intent here is to preserve the land. I think the concern that we have at this point is that we have assigned a task to the department to manage the land and realize a profit for the education of our children. I think that what we are seeing is that this is not sustainable. What is going to happen, what some of us fear will happen, is that if we, exploit the land in a way that is no longer profitable, neither the schools or the state will have land. Neither the schools will not have the profit that they need. The state will not have the land. So when we look at the future of this model, this was done when we had a lot of land. And so the intent here was that we could use some of this land to create some profit for our children. As the state develops and we look for mechanisms to get funding into education, we see that this model that we have right now is simply not sustainable. We could end up with a development project, for instance, in a lake, where you sell the land, that we no longer have that for our children, and we no longer have a source of profit for the schools. We have neither. We have no land. We have no land to manage in order to create a profit. So what we're proposing here to your committee is that create a process or a funding mechanism to protect the land. That's basically what it is. And that, obviously, the reason is that we created a model that, you know, we feel is not sustainable because in the long term, you know, this funding is given to the schools to provide it. We may talk about, you know, other ways to, and we are in other committees, of course, to increase the funding for education and who is responsible for paying for the education of these children, of our children. But in this particular instance, really the intent here is to preserve the land for the future, to protect our environment. That's what we're trying to do.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, it looks like we're giving some eminent domain authority to the DNR here. Is that right? And how does that work?
Go ahead.
Section B, or am I reading?
No, you're right.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom, this bill was drafted up by the revisor's office and using standard language that has been used in the past when school trust lands, when the trust obligation has been, I call it, canceled on school trust lands. This is not any additional authority that has not been exercised before, and this is the mechanism by which the trust has been indemnified. There are people here from the Department of Natural Resources if you'd like to inquire further of that.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, one of the issues here is the Constitution requires that these school trust lands be sold at public sale. So you can't really direct the sale, but a condemnation has been considered a public sale because there's a public process for it. So whenever the state has acquired an interest in school trust lands in the past, they've gone through the condemnation process because of the public sale restrictions. The state, you can't direct a sale between the state just acquire them without a condemnation process. There has to be some type of a public process for it.
So, Mr. Knopf, or to the witness, what has to happen here is basically the land that we're intending to get here, the DNR is going to buy the fee simple title from the school trust lands, pay them up to $5 million or whatever the appraised value is, and the school trust lands can put that money in and use it to generate interest or return towards the school trust lands. Am I closing the circle here?
That is correct, Senator Westrom. That's correct. How you explained it is exactly how this bill proposes that we move forward.
And it would be intended lands that you're talking about, the prairies that the school trust lands currently hold. What was it, the change last year or 2 years ago that talks about trying to use highest and best? If they do that on this land, your concern is that it may not stay in the prairies and you'd rather have it sold to the state so they can manage it as the prairies. School trust land gets the cash and either reinvests it in other lands or return on investment from interest or some return that way. Am I closing the loop here?
That's correct, Senator Westrom. That's correct. Our intent is to preserve the land and to manage it in a sustainable way. That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are 2.5 million acres of these lands, and each parcel has its own story. We've tried to use as illustration the real example of 7,300 acres of native prairie that would be an example of the type of land that perhaps the DNR would like to unencumber from its obligation to generate revenue for the school trust. Another example is we have a number of boat launches and boat accesses to public lakes that are located on public trust land. Should we be selling those parcels to a private entity to put a home on it and close the public access, or is the public good better off that we compensate the trust land, for example, for that particular parcel, maintain it as a public access point, and be done with it? All of these lands are in public ownership right now. It really comes down to what is the responsibility of the state. And we're saying there are two very solid Minnesota values at conflict here. One is our great desire to take care of our children for their education, you know, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. The other one is to provide for their resource needs and to protect natural resources. We think this bill will allow the Department of Natural Resources, in consultation with the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission, which is made up of 12 legislators that was established in the legislation in the last year, in consultation with them, they will be able to decide where the right parcels are that should have this trust obligation canceled out.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand, although we aren't, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chaplain, we aren't in the highest and best use mode yet. We're just contemplating it, right?
Well, I think the transition is starting to occur. Last year's legislation directed the DNR to move forward on that, and they're in the process of deciding what and where.
Yeah. Well, I don't argue with that, and I certainly don't argue with the fact that we need to be putting the proceeds of our natural resources and that are dedicated to school trust into the education fund, and we really only started doing that about 4 years ago. Everybody talks about it like it's been going on forever, but only been going on for 4 years. So that's all fine too, and I appreciate the fact that so you're going to bond and you're going to put this in that fund. What the question I always come up with, this whole school trust fund discussion seems to in some way, and I'm not blaming the three of you in any particular way, but the DNR always seems to be the one that either is charged with spending too much in managing it or told to manage it for nothing. And I haven't really come to grips with this yet. And we'd just like to know, I guess, how we're going to pay the managers of our natural resources and trust fund lands and regular lands. I guess that's just a rhetorical question, but I'll be pursuing it.
It's a very good rhetorical question, because what we end up doing is costing the school trust fund money by taking all the proceeds off the land and not ever putting it into the fund.
Mr. Chairman, you're right, except that the problem being that that managing timber is not a particularly easy or cost-effective thing to do, particularly when you have to take care of the fires for the whole state of Minnesota.
And if you talk about $5 million for 2.5 million acres, you get $2 an acre, and which is what I'm wondering why we don't have an appraisal on this land. Because when I think about what happened up in the Boundary Waters, where there's 93,000 acres of trust land that's been locked up in the Boundary Waters that we're trying to exchange with the federal government so that we can make it productive land, and it would be a simple land exchange, we were told we have to get an appraisal, and then when we get the appraisal and it takes 4.5 years at the federal government to approve it, then they say the appraisal is no good, you got to do the appraisal again, and so then we can never get the darn thing done. And so here we are trying to get productive trust lands out of the Boundary Waters into the state of Minnesota, and we can't do it. So it's a pretty interesting situation that's going on there, and hopefully eventually here it gets done. But all this stuff is good. The obvious problem we got with this is that we're paying debt service on $5 million to put it into a trust fund that might not be generating as much money as the debt service is, and so then we're all of a sudden losing money at the state level, and so I'm not sure that bonding proceeds are the right way to go, but maybe this is a good idea on how to do some of this. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad idea or a wrong idea. Actually, I'm one of three senators on this committee that was recently appointed to the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission. And as a result, we had a meeting this morning. So I have a clue of what you're talking about. Prior to that, I wouldn't have had any clue of what you were talking about. but in any event, I guess a couple of things. Number one, I think right now there is a much more thorough inventory being conducted of those lands and exactly what the potential uses are for some of them. We talk about some of the wetter lands in Kuchiching, for example, that don't generate any income at this point in time, and yet they do have the potential for wetland mitigation, being able to have money paid for them for that purpose, thereby generating income at the same time accomplishing the natural environment aspect that you're talking about. And I'm really starting to echo today here.
Maybe get closer.
Yeah, I can really blow everything out here. And then also the other thing, I tend to agree with the chairman concerning the appraisal end of things. And there was a comment made, and I may have misinterpreted what was said, and I would like to clarify that. As you talked about the DNR being entrusted or instructed to manage this on a highest and best use basis, and then there was a statement made about being acquiring this. It was like acquiring it before that actually happens. But wouldn't we expect to reimburse the school trust for the actual highest and best use value at that point?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's right. I should clear up right from the very beginning. If we made this impression, this is not $5 million for 2 million acres of trust fund land. This is just the start of the process that will include probably an appraisal for every piece that actually gets transferred along there. The appraisal is based on the highest and best used, and so the lands that would be transferred would be valued at their highest and best use.
Well, I would think so, and being a licensed appraiser, that's always the preface that of which you're approaching the market value, but I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't something different intended here. Thank you, Mr.
Who determines highest and best use?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the DNR, under your instructions with the legislation you passed last year, is engaged in a process right now where they will be delivering a report to you at the end of this year that parcel by parcel goes through and determines what they're categorizing lands into various types of development activities or no possibility. There's much of this land where there's really no identifiable potential source of revenue. And the intention with this bill is to make available to them at real time. Remember, the authority, assuming you pass this, would not go into effect till August. The bonds wouldn't be issued until they were required. But in real time, the DNR plus the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission could be saying, okay, we have this report with highest and best use. We have some very high-value natural resource lands where there's a lot of heartburn on the part of conservation-minded people saying, we don't want to close down this public lake access and sell it off for recreational development. We don't want to plow this prairie for more cornfields. We don't want to log designated old growth. We want to preserve that for our children. What do we do about it? The legislation you passed last year said the DNR should come up with a plan to compensate the school trust land if those natural resource values are to be preserved in those high conflict situations. We're suggesting with a modest pot of money, such as $5 million, the committee could go to work and say, are there some of these areas where we can all agree the best thing to do is to compensate the school trust for the value, but not do the development and retain the natural resource values for our children?
Senator Ingber,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe you can answer this or the author can. This is certainly not the first stop. Has it been discussed in policy and K-12 education? Or can you give me a little idea as to where it goes? I guess it certainly takes in K-12 education as well as certainly a fairly significant policy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is our first stop.
This is the first stop, and she's looking for bonding funds, so I'm assuming it goes to bonding after this. But if the committee wants, we can refer it out of here to finance and then send it on to another committee. But since it's bonding funds, it would have to be considered at the capital bonding level, correct? Senator Saxon.
So one final question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arnosky, so how many feet did we say there was on Vermilion?
My understanding is there's 16 miles of public lakeshore in school trust lands on Vermilion. That could be verified by the DNR.
Yeah, and we know that that's developable, or it could be developable. So if you were going to go by what we were talking about here, you'd take 16 miles times, I know, conservatively, good and bad, $300 a foot, front foot?
Could be. I'm not a real estate
appraiser. Oh, that would be good for the school trust. But it does make a really good point, if we're going to do what the trust was intended for, we probably ought to pay for it and put that in the school and forget about it.
And at $300 a foot and sold to a private person
for 16 miles,
you might not be able to get investment in the school trust either. Senator Weber was next, and Senator Rood.
Just to thank you, Mr. Chairman, to relate to your earlier question in the determination of highest and best use, in the valuation process, it would typically be your appraiser that determines the highest and best use, because they're going to look at the potential use of the land, the market conditions, the ability to utilize it. Just because you have a shore frontage, for example, doesn't mean it's automatically prime development, depending on the ability to access it and that type of thing. And then the follow-up, not that I'm proposing, I don't believe we should sell off every foot of shoreline we have, but you alluded to the fact that, you know, if you sell it and there's a home developed or it is developed in some manner, it continues to pay real estate taxes, which continue to help support the schools as well. So there's a variety of issues to take into consideration here.
The loop closes differently sometimes.
That's right.
Senator Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This morning we met for really our first full meeting of the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission. And I think right now, I understand where you're trying to go with this, but there's a lot of policy that needs to be discussed with this bill before it just comes to this committee and we send it off. I think it would be a very good bill to sit and bring back to the policy committee and talk about all the issues that are in this bill right here. I think this is really premature to do this, especially since we just had our very first commission meeting, and we are really talking about our roles and what our fiduciary responsibility is on that commission. So while I understand where they're trying to go with this, I think it needs a lot more policy discussion than what we can give it here today.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Rood, Senators. You know, this is a conversation that, you know, Senator Saxo, is not a new conversation. We've been looking at this issue for a number of years. I think the important thing for this committee is really, I believe, to review kind of the sustainability of this model, as well as really preserving the land. And I think that's what I'm trying to present here, Senators. I do believe that one of the reasons, and for the members, Senator Weber, Senator Saxok, are in the Finance Committee, what we're seeing is that more and more we are looking for ideas on how to support education. And, we are having significant problems. You know, people feel that we're paying too much taxes and we shouldn't. So how we manage this land and how you know, the mandate to really get maximum, you know, the revenue from these land is really a model that I believe is not sustainable. And that's what we're proposing to really figure out a new way and just set aside some money to really begin to protect some of these very important parcels of land for the future of our state. A lot of these parcels are connected to water. They are going, there's a, obviously, you know, you can say the value today of this land is such that, you know, you sell it and then you're done with it and it goes to the fund. Well, how long, you know, are you going to be able to support education with that piece of money that you just got with that, you know, that budget? And then your land is gone. And if that's, you know, what we want to do for the future of the state, I mean, be it. But I think that our responsibility and the responsibility of this committee is to really look for, you know, a sustainable model through which we can preserve the land and really look at different ways to, you know, begin to see these pieces of land and have the resources available to protect it. I think that's the proposal before you, Mr. Chairman and Senators.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't disagree with what you're saying, Senator, but I do have some concerns similar to what Senator Rood and Senator Saxog have said with regards to managing those properties and how new the new committee is. I mean, that one time, I hope that's not me, but maybe it is. Throw my phone on the floor.
It's hit the floor.
It's actually hit the floor more than once today. That's another story. But I'm very concerned about the Commissioner of Natural Resources just giving $5 million and not hearing any testimony in this committee. And I just really think this is probably – and I'm on the bonding committee. That's, you know, that's fine. I'll be more than happy to deal with it there. But I think it has an awful lot of policy in it before we would just send it off, it seems to me. So that is not me. Maybe it's just me.
Wires in your head.
It's in the wires in my head.
Well, members, I think there's – been a pretty good discussion here, and there's some concern from the committee about where this should go next and whether or not it should go anywhere, or whether or not the commission should maybe discuss it even more. So let's do this. I will lay this over, and I'll talk to the bonding chair about it. And in the meantime, there could be a judicial policy in here that judiciary might want to see. And we'll see what happens. I don't know if the bonding chair will want to deal with the policy, so I kind of doubt that, but the commission is definitely in this thing and needs to be dealt with, and I think we have some questions about whether or not appraisal of the land should happen instead of just determination of the value by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So I'll just lay this over for possible inclusion or recommendation to the bonding committee and see if anybody decides to request it in the very near future. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And now it's me.
Yep.
My wires are. I think some legitimate policy issues have been raised. Laying it on the table is a good idea. I hope everyone is of a posture, though. It seems like everyone seems to think there's a couple of good ideas in here that everyone seems to support, and so I hope that's sincere, because it seems like we're solving a number of folks' issues and problems at the same time, preserving sensitive environmental ecological areas, protecting the school trust lands and the income that flows to the school trust. So it's a good idea that solves a couple of problems at the same time. So I do hope we continue to work on this and move this idea along.
Well, and I think we will, because it's been going on for a number of years. It's not as if we haven't been doing this before. But I think the fact that it's this year's bill and that it's before this committee for the first time, and it's the first time that this legislature is discussing it, that it brings up the issue about previous legislatures trying to, you know, bind us to what they said or did, and us binding future legislatures to what they do. And so I think just laying it over for right now and talking to the bonding chair, and maybe Senator Torres-Ray, you may want to talk to the bonding chair also about this and see if we can get some other kind of feedback. And like I said, maybe this is something that we wait to see how the commission deals with it in regard to its consultation with the Natural Resources Commissioner also. So we'll lay over Senate File 517 for a possible recommendation to the responding chair. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
Good
Chairman.
Discussion.
Thank you, members.
I think you can do it.
Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Senator Gary Deems, and I have with me today Carrie Netsky, and Carrie is the Executive Director of Area 2. And I'm here to introduce Senate File Number 1542. Senate File 1542 is a request for an appropriation of $425,000 from the capital investment to be given to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for a grant for the Area 2 River Basin Project. These funds shall be used to acquire, design, and construct flood water retention systems for the Lake Yankton flood water retention study, which is within the Des Moines River watershed. Included in your packet, I believe you have a handout that was given out. So if you want to follow with that, at this point, I'll turn it over to Carrie for further information on the project.
Ms. Netsky.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Carrie Netsky. I'm the executive director for Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects based out of Marshall. We are a nine-county joint powers board, and we specialize with floodwater retention, specifically in southwestern Minnesota. I do bring apologies from two county commissioners who had planned to be with me today, Murray County Commissioner Bob Moline and Lyon County Commissioner Rick Anderson. Just due to giving short notice of the hearing, they were unable to joggle their schedules, but they've been instrumental with this project since the onset. Again, Senator Deems had mentioned there's a handout. If you'd like to follow along, you certainly can. I won't read it to you, but I will just highlight basically what the issue is. Lake Yankton is about a 400-acre lake in southwestern Minnesota in southern Lyon County. And as you know, the lakes in southwestern Minnesota are far and few between, so the good quality ones we certainly preserve to our very best. Here, the water levels have been problematic for many years, especially to the 30 homes and cabins that live around the lake. Naturally, the water level is either too high or too low. Many attempts have been made to assure more constant level, but those solutions have not been successful. In the fall of 2010, there was a series of rainfall events that caused significant rise in Lake Yankton, forcing it to its highest recorded level, which was 2 feet or over the ordinary high water level mark. Damage to the shoreline and, of course, flooding in the adjacent homes and the city of Ballaton occurred. The most distressing part is that this lake level stayed that high through those winter months. And due to a very wet spring in 2011, the level persisted several months into 2011 as well. So basically, the lake suffers extended periods of flooding, and those floodwaters cannot discharge from that lake. If you refer to the picture, not the top one where the locator, but the one off to the right-hand side, it's a little bit of an aerial view of the city of Ballaton and the lake. The outlet for the lake is at the south end. It flows under Trunk Highway 16 and through a wetland. That flow then goes into a heavily vegetated ditch where a large watershed from the south, it's 47 square miles in size, join. And at that point, that becomes the headwaters to the Des Moines River. What happens is that when significant flows from that southern watershed reach that confluence, that the floodwaters actually back up into Lake Yankton and then are not able to recede. This has been reported by landowners, and a hydraulic study that was conducted confirmed that that is indeed the case. To address this issue, a coalition consisting of Lyon County, Murray County, and the city of Ballaton pooled their resources to hire Bolton and Mink to conduct a hydraulic study of these watersheds and to determine if storing floodwaters in that large southern watershed could have a good positive benefit at stabilizing those lake levels of Lake Yankton. The study concluded that, again, that floodwaters do indeed are a problem to the lake and that creating storage will have some impact on stabilizing those levels. Floodwater storage will also have positive effects as far as terms of downstream flows and then also water quality. The study located 7 retention sites. Other options of that study concluded that there could be clean out of the downstream channel and construction of a pump station at the outlet. The outlet channel is very flat. There are a few areas of higher elevation that could be cleaned out, but in general, they do not feel that is the main problem. And the construction of a pump outlet, the pump station would require 3 50-horsepower pumps to discharge 5,800 gallons per minute for approximately a week in order to get those lake levels back down. The cost of that station and those pumps plus the operation maintenance would be substantial considering the benefit. The coalition chose to hold a public meeting and sought landowners who were willing to help with that upstream floodwater retention, and two of them stepped forward and are willing to move ahead. Site number one and site number four are basically ready to go. If you flip to the back side of your handout, site number one and number four, not very well highlighted, but they are there. I'll just recap briefly what those sites involve. Site number one will store about 140 acre-feet of a 100-year storm. It will be an earthen dam at a construction cost of about $207,000. Site number four will actually be a road retention structure. What they do is that road retention, basically they'll take out the bridge that's there. They'll downsize that opening to a smaller culvert that will meter out those flows. And then the roadway is actually built up to act as a temporary dam to just temporarily hold those floodwaters or fast snowmelt that comes off. This particular site will store 90 acre-feet of waters. It will be a significant holding site. It'll hold about 19% of the flow coming into it, and at a construction cost of about $290,000. As a summary, they estimate construction of both retention sites plus needed engineering acquisition at $560,000. The coalition sources are prepared to contribute $135,000. Leaving our request for bonding at $425,000. This would be $3 of state funds for every dollar of local funds contributed to the project. I'd be happy to entertain any questions if there are any.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the proposed dam. Who would own it and maintain it for the future? And also, what would that dam do to the area that it's going to be damming up? I mean, would it change a wetland to a lake, or what would happen with that area?
So Mr. Chair and Senator, that proposed dam, if I remember right, and I apologize, I'm not the expert on this project. We are serving more as the engineering side of things. The two commissioners who weren't able here, they'd be able to answer it more clearly. From what I remember in that study, Site 1, the dam is actually in a pasture in Lyon County. I cannot speak to whether there are any current wetlands. Typically, the type of wetlands that we have in southwestern Minnesota are more linear. They'll typically follow the creek that's running through there, not the large wetland complexes or like what you see at the outlet to this lake. The second question, as far as ownership, the ownership of the dam will stay with that landowner. On the record, he will be responsible for the operation and maintenance. Typically, the county works in conjunction with the landowner with a sizable project like this, but he will still retain ownership, still pay taxes on the land as before, and it would be under his ownership.
Ms. Netsky, if commissioners or anything like senators, they'd defer to the engineer to answer the question.
I tried to bring the engineer along as well, and he had a bid opening it too, so I couldn't do that either.
So this little lake's causing all that problem, huh?
Yes, it is.
And did you get $1 million in 2011 for the same thing, or was it for something else?
Mr. Chair, that is something different. This is a project that is actually just outside of the Area 2 watershed. This is actually the headwaters of the Des Moines, just across what flows into the Minnesota watershed. The $1 million appropriation that we received is for work within the Minnesota River watershed, doing very similar projects, dams, road retentions, and things of that nature.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Maybe Senator Dames can answer this. Would this dam potentially stop any invasives? Any talk of that during your committee meetings at all? I mean, it's going that direction. Any concerns at all?
I would refer that to Carrie, the administrator. I'm not sure on that. Senator Ingebrigtsen. Carrie, do you have any comments on that?
Senator, The dams and road retentions that we build put in typical culverts and bridges and things like that. We typically we don't incorporate any kind of invasive control measures. It's certainly something we can investigate.
No.
But just from my own knowledge, I don't see how it would, because that there would still be a passage through that the dam or the road retention.
Yeah, it's something I can talk to the Mr. Chair, the senator about. I'm not exactly familiar with it, but if it's going south, there were some concerns there, but I'm good with that. Thanks.
Okay. Any other? Hope, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just two questions. I'll mix them together. You mentioned that this project would have some benefit or control on the lake high waters. Can you just expand on that a little bit more when you say some? Is it not going to fix the high water much? It's going to fix most of it. Just any thoughts on that or comments on that? And then secondly, I appreciate you hearing it. If I understand the proposal correctly, you're looking at natural waterways to help back up some of this water, which seems to be an efficient or a less expensive way to go in many cases. So I commend you for that. And is that sufficient to make enough holding funds?
Mr. Chair and Senator, your first question, which I just
gets worse as you get older.
I was going to say, I was focusing on the second one. I'll answer your second question first. When you asked about are these natural retention areas, yes, they are. What they're doing is they're looking at the watershed using all the latest technology, the LIDAR data and you know aerial topography, and they are finding areas for natural water retention and then just expounding on them. So that is what we do. Forgive me, I forgot what your
first question. You said it would give some benefit to the lake from high waters. What's the level of some? I mean, is this going to help the lakes enough to really deal with that, or is that another issue we need to deal with in the future?
Senator, the report was not real specific as far as what they meant by some. Ideally, if all seven retention structures could be built, that's where you would get the most benefit. I do recall a report saying that it was not the cure. It's not going to totally fix or totally stabilize those lake levels, but was going to have enough effect that they would recommend pursuing that route.
So follow up to the – you made comment about the three pumps of 5,800 gallons a minute. Is that not part of this proposal? Is that something they thought was too expensive to justify or warrant, or is that going to be part of your proposal? And if so, who's going to pay for the upkeep of the pumps and the management day-to-day, month-to-month?
Mr. Chair and Senator, you're correct. The pump station is not being considered. The coalition felt that the expense was just too extreme for such a you know infrequent storm that they felt that going with the stormwater retention route was a better bang for the buck and something that they could more easily implement and afford.
Very good. Thanks.
Any further comments, questions? Okay. Thank you, Senator Dames. We'll take Senate File 1542 and lay it over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the Bonding Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Conan. Senate File 1522. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be back. Senate, this bill is a bonding request for the city of Maynard. There's two parts to it. One of it is for flood hazard mitigation, which includes increasing the height of a berm for flood control in Maynard. And the other request is for money for the Public Facilities Authority for a grant for the City of Maynard for infrastructure. And within the last 10 days, Maynard finds itself in an emergency situation. They've had a pump system fail and a sewer line under the railroad tracks collapse. And so the city engineer is there now evaluating the situation. And so with that in mind, the dollar amounts that are in the bill on lines 1.6, 1.11, and 1.16 may be changed depending upon what the engineer comes up with here in the next day or two. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I have with me today from Maynard Mr. John Meyer, and he can tell you a little bit more about the bonding request that Maynard has here.
Welcome, Mr. Mayor. Just say your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is John Meyer. I'm the city financial advisor.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm here to kind of expound on what Senator Coonan has said. The mayor, Richard Grotus, would like to be here also, but he's in the middle of an emergency situation. He declared a disaster emergency declaration on April 4th, and today they're having a meeting out there to come up with some remedies, short-term remedies, so that this problem doesn't get worse. So as you can see, and Senator Coonan alluded to, on the 20th of March, the primary lift station collapsed. Built in 54, should have been addressed, attempted to be addressed for the last 4 years, unsuccessfully addressed with funding. This was exacerbated by March 31st, Easter Sunday, when the main line that ran under the railroad track collapsed, blocking sewage from the north to the south. So now they're pumping waste in fields and things with the permission of pollution control to avoid any waste going in people's basements and backyards and other places. So they got a significant issue, and they're dealing with it, or attempting to deal with it as best they can. Maynard is in Chippewa County, a small town of 388 people. Big price tag for the improvement, $2.8 million. This isn't a new problem, as I mentioned. They've studied this. They've hired an engineer. They've been trying to solicit for funding for 4 years. This might be the second or third time it's come here to the legislature looking for money. And now they're kind of faced with an issue that they need to move forward one way or the other. And they're trying to do that today with the emergencies. The system I alluded to was built in 54. It's vitrified clay, old crumbly stuff that falls apart. All the components are old, built in 54, need to be replaced. In the last 4 years, with the high water table you've been hearing about, much like Lake Yankton, people are getting water and waste in their basement, to the point that this sewage and things has been showing up, and the city has been having to tap its insurance company to pay for the claims. In fact, the League of Cities Insurance Trust has told them if this continues, they're going to drop them from coverage. So they got some real urgent issues. Senator Coonan alluded to the fact that the city engineer is out there today kind of putting in the interim steps. I believe the price tag for them is going to be about $500,000. But unfortunately, they need to be forward. So with this comes this request for financial support for flooding. And flooding comes from the berm on the west side of town that further exaggerates the sanitary sewer problem, because as the water floods, it goes into the cracks and sags and holes in the collection system and into people's basements. So it's just a disaster, and it's happened. So we're here needing support and assistance from the committee and the state. Thank you.
Thank you. So did the flood cause the pumps to fail? Or?
A high water table, flooding over the berm, and the condition of the lines and the age of the pumps caused it all to fail. Kind of like the perfect storm.
Perfect emergency also.
Yeah.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not trying to point any fingers at this study, but most cities have you pay more on your sewer bill for 60 years, and then all of a sudden when something fails, you've got kind of a fund built up for replacement, and a lot of cities do that, and I don't know what they did here, so I'm not trying to point fingers, but when we help somebody out like this, we almost have to in the future ask that they provide a maintenance fund, because we've got a lot of places in the state that have clay pipes and lift stations that are 60 years old, so it's something that could be a huge issue in the future. I'm just kind of bringing it out for the committee to think about. I know my community's got clay pipes that are old. And I think that we've got to be very careful. But we have an enterprise fund so that whenever we pay our sewer bill, we pay a little bit extra through the whole 60-year period. So at the time when something fails, then you've got money to replace it. So I'm just kind of throwing it out there for people to think about as we look at all these emergency situations in the state.
Well, I think we have this situation all over the state. I think you're right. In fact, I was built in 1952, and I needed new hips at 58 years old. So I can understand this 60-year-old thing. So.
We're on record, right?
I'll talk to you.
So, okay. So, do you have a response to Senator Scalzi that you have the same? Because I know where I'm from, we have the same kind of situation where we pay way more on our sewer bill than we pay on our water bill. So, are you in the same situation there?
Chairman, Mr. Chair, Senator, the cities, and I worked with numbers of them, good, bad, or otherwise, all set aside a certain portion of funds for asset replacement. What they run into, of course, is by the time they get to the replacement, the asset has gone up in the expense so that whatever was set aside doesn't come close to satisfying the need for the improvement. The other thing that happens is those costs have to be passed on to a water sewer rate schedule. And those sewer rate schedules, if you try to balance collecting the money with the rate schedule as it relates to everywhere else, it would be astronomical. So most cities choose to not fully depreciate their assets. In fact, if you check with your city, they're going to find out that they might depreciate that asset 25% just to keep their rate more in line. So that further exacerbates the problem when they need replacement.
Yes, and in rural communities, we're all being required to do, and probably in the metro area also, being required to do all kinds of remediation on our water systems and our wastewater systems, and the tax base is always so low that you can't do it by yourself, and you need help from the state, and then there's not enough money at the state to help, and so then we go to the PFA, and it's ranked in some kind of priority, and if you don't have the right numbers, you don't get the money, and so then you put it off until the next year, and then next thing you know, you have an emergency. So when you requested money from the USDA, was that at after March 31st, or was it prior to that? Or
Mr. Chair, that was prior to March 31st.
And so they didn't understand that you were telling them the truth, huh?
Thank you for that.
Okay.
Thank you
for that. Okay. Is there any further comments or questions? Senator Coonan, and if you find out the numbers are different, we'll let the bonding chair know. This I would think this is something that we probably have to deal with because it sounds like you're in a really bad situation, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, and this is a much broader discussion than we want to get into, but I've just set it for the record. Maynard's not unlike a lot of our communities as we were talking about, but at some point, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in us digging into the policy because sometimes it's our own agencies that we change the rules of the game. And, in this case, obviously we got to get this sewer line fixed, and that's a problem. But just in some other instances, I know it seems like the rules of the game change and all of a sudden they're out of compliance when a year before they were in compliance. And so, it's kind of the bigger discussion because as you kind of get more precise and less and less allowances, it does cost their small cities a lot more money. And think back to the PFA testimony we had earlier this session where rural cities are paying quite a bit more than a larger urban city just because of the numbers, and that is an issue.
And I agree. Okay, we'll lay over Senate File 1522 for possible inclusion and a recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much, Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schmidt, you're next on the list.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm pleased to be here today to talk about the Goodhue Pioneer Trail in southeastern Minnesota. The trail envisions connecting.
Where were you the other day when we had all the trails up?
Yeah. We just thought that we'd be different and come back today. And You can never talk too much about trails, especially in southeastern Minnesota.
We did get bored with trails that day, so this is good to hear.
So we want to keep it fresher on a Monday, so I hope you can appreciate that. So what we're proposing here is to take the next step in completing a vision that began decades ago, and that is linking two existing trails in southeastern Minnesota, the Cannon Valley Trail that connects Red Wing and Cannon Falls, and the Douglas Trail that extends from Pine Island down to Rochester and beyond. And there's approximately 40 miles in between the two. We have about 10 of those miles that are currently paved. What this proposes to do is take the next step in complete pavement between Goodhue and Zumbrota along this trail. And I have two great testifiers here who could speak to this, but I would just, before we get into that, I'd just like to mention that the trail would connect Hay Creek in a recreational area, also the Goodhue County Agricultural Museum, and also a lot of great recreational opportunities, including the Covered Bridge Park in Zumbrota. And there's a lot going on down here, and I think it's a key asset for bringing folks into southeastern Minnesota to recreate. I can tell you I use the trail, and we'd like to see it completed in terms of linking up these two existing trails. With that said,
Senator Schmidt, is this this thing here, is that like where the Headless Horseman rode through, or what?
It's Sleepy Hollow, actually. Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's what I'm wondering. Okay.
You know, we have the Covered Bridge Festival down in Zumbrota, and of course there is a covered bridge, so that's it right there before you.
The Covered Bridge Festival, huh?
That's right, and there's a Covered Bridge Park.
I like it.
So, you know, Senator Tomasoni, if we complete this trail, you could come down there with your bike, and you might be able to bike along the Covered Bridge, so see it for yourself.
No.
That'd help your knees out a lot.
My hips.
Oh, yes.
My knees are good yet. Okay, who wants to go first?
Go ahead, Roxanne.
Thank you. I'm Roxanne Bartsch. I'm from Zumbrota, Minnesota, and I'm representing the Goodhue Pioneer Trail Association. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly about this bonding request. As Senator Schmidt said, we've been at this for quite a long time, actually since 1994, is when the state legislature first authorized the Goodhue Pioneer Trail as a state trail. Since that time, we have received approximately $3.2 million, some of that in the form of bonding money, some of that in the form of grants, both state and federal grants. As Senator Schmidt said, when it's completed, it's going to travel all the way through Goodhue County on the north end from Red Wing and to the south end in Pine Island. It's a multi-use trail, includes use for walking, running, bicycling, inline skating, horseback riding. Anything you want to do, we can do down there for you. It also will include snowmobiling and cross-country skiing for winter recreation. As Senator Schmidt said, we currently have 10 miles completed. There's a 5-mile section that goes from Red Wing out to Hay Creek. The most recent section that was completed approximately 3 years ago was a 5-mile section that goes from Zumbrota north towards Goodhue. And this bonding request would be to complete that Zumbrota-Goodhue link. It's a total of approximately 5 miles. The state currently owns about 3 of those 5 miles. So this bonding request would acquire the other 2 miles and then grade and engineer and pave the entire 5 miles. I also should mention that the Goodhue Pioneer Trail has worked closely in the last, for many, many years with the Minnesota Parks and Trails Association. And we've been included before in some of their bonding requests. In fact, a few years ago, the same request came before both the House and the Senate. Unfortunately, when it got to the governor's desk, it didn't make it that far. So this is a request that has come before the legislature before.
Go back now. Did it get to the governor's desk and got
vetoed? It got vetoed at the governor, yeah. But it did get there. So it's a request that's been heard.
He did a lot of that.
Yeah. So anyway, but we're persistent and we're back. I'd like to just make a few comments about what cities and the counties are doing to promote trails. The cities of Red Wing, Goodhue, and Zumbrota have all created extensive city trails that will connect directly to the Goodhue Pioneer Trail. Also, the County of Goodhue recently purchased some land in the Lake Bilsby area. And why this was important is that this piece of land was important in connecting the Milltown Trail, which you probably heard about last week, with the Cannon Valley Trail. And it would not have happened without the support of Goodhue County. And the City of Zumbrota recently purchased a parcel of land adjacent to this beautiful covered bridge.
from a private party, and that land will be used for our community center and also will be the trailhead for the Goodhue Pioneer Trail. So the city has great support for this project. I'm sure most of you on this committee have trails in your district. Although we know they serve a great health and quality of life benefit to our communities, they also add tremendous economic growth to the changing landscape of our rural areas. The McKnight Foundation several years ago did a study called Bright Stars, and I don't know if any of you have read it, but it was a very interesting study. And basically they said that if rural communities want to survive, they need to build their economies through recreation and the arts. Communities like Lanesboro are a good example of this. I did put it in your packet. You might be wondering why I'm putting things from Fillmore County. But to illustrate the impact this can make, I put an information sheet on gross sales revenue in Fillmore County that started from 1986 through 2010. Total sales from these areas, and they tracked recreation, lodging, food, and drink. Total sales from these areas rose from about $6 million in 1986 to near $19 million in 2010. What changed in this rural county to see the dramatic increase? Trails. Recreation, primarily through trails, along with the infusion of arts, bed and breakfasts, and specialty shops. I've lived in Zumbrota for approximately 30 years, and I've personally witnessed the change in this small rural community. The farm structure has changed from a small family farms to big corporate operations. Our downtown has lost many of the mom-and-pop operations that serve local needs to the big box stores in Rochester. However, I'm excited that over the past 5 to 8 years, Zumbrota has started to change and become more of an arts, recreation, and shopping destination. What's happening to make this change? A local person opened a business called Crossings. She has a wonderful store filled with art. She holds art classes for adults and children 2 to 3 times a week. She has concerts, music concerts, 4 to 5 times each month. Last Saturday night, I helped volunteer for one of the concerts. Over 220 people were in our small theater. And probably, as I said to Senator Schmidt, maybe 10% of them were from Zumbrota. The remaining came, many people from the Twin Cities drove the 50 miles down to Zumbrota. Also, our local arts council in the last 2 years raised over $350,000 locally to purchase our movie theater. The movie theater in small towns, like many other small towns, could not survive, you know, with the megaplexes in nearby communities. But it was pretty impressive that we were able to raise this money locally. And with that, today the theater is in full operation. We hold theatrical performances, concerts, and now we're showing classic movies. And in 2010, 5 miles of the Goodhue Pioneer Trail were completed. This section is a great complement to the existing trail system and our 7-acre park located in Zumbrota. Our downtown has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. Specialty shops such as Unique Boutiques, a quilt shop, a yarn and fiber shop, and an upscale consignment shop have all replaced the businesses that long ago supported the needs of our rural economy. My husband and I became actively involved in this downtown change when we purchased a historic building about 10 years ago. We've been slowly rehabbing this beautiful structure. I left my profession as a probation officer of 27 years to open a boutique in our building about 5 years ago. Despite opening my business right before the 2007 recession, I've shown a profit every year. Every day I get to meet and interact with the people who travel to our community to shop, take an art class, go to a concert, or ride their bike. People love to visit a Main Street shop. They love to enjoy the parks, love to go to the diner and have a real roast beef sandwich, the ones with mashed potatoes and gravy. Trails are not the only answer
homemade,
to...
Homemade, I imagine.
Homemade, yeah, and then finish it off with that good pie. Actually, the president did stop in Zumbrota and had homemade pie.
I like it.
Yes, a couple years ago.
You got a picture, right?
We do have a picture. Go to the coffee mill, she's got a whole wall dedicated to it. Trails are not the only answer to redefining our rural communities, but when you have a winning combination like we do in Zumbrota and other cities along the Goodhue Pioneer Trail, they can make it the home run. This bonding request is a real investment for the state by providing jobs, increasing sales and income tax revenue, and ultimately improving the quality of life for our citizens. Support for this project will help Minnesota move forward in redefining the economic development of our rural communities. A state with quality of life assets makes it a place that people want to be part of and bring their families and businesses to Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Sir, go ahead, just say your name for the record.
My name's Neil Jensen. I'm a city administrator in Zumbrota. I'd like to thank you for letting us speak today. When you're a small city and you look for economic development, you try, as Roxanne said, to look in many different ways, especially in the rural area. The Pioneer Trail, once it's connected to Red Wing, will be a great destination to come and ride up the 20, 25 miles and maybe swing over to Cannon Falls and then ride back. It's going to produce growth for our town. It's I know the City Council is very supportive of it because we just recently purchased a nice piece of property right by the Zumbro River to put a trailhead on in anticipation of this link. I would just like to ask your support for this bonding because I think it's going to serve well for our community and the communities along the Goodhue Trail.
One thing about rural Minnesota, it's not an exact science, this economic development stuff, but we just keep trying whatever we can. And you got to keep digging away at it, I think. Yeah. Sounds like you've had some success, so that's very good. Are there any comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Senator Schmidt. We'll lay over Senate file 1519 for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you. Senator Herr. Senate File 142, Senator Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for allowing me to introduce to you Senate File 142. This bill is seeking for...
You have an A1 amendment, Senator?
Oh, yes. That's coming around, A1 amendment.
And so Senator Herr moves the A1 amendment. This is the first time it's been heard, so it puts it in the shape that the author would like. So all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you. Senator Herr.
And this bill is seeking for appropriation of $500,000 from bonding proceeds to design and engineer improvement of Pig's Eyes Regional Park and Pig's Eyes Lake. This park is about a mile southeast from here, from the Capitol, and it's located along the Mississippi River. We will appreciate your support to this project to improve the water quality and the wildlife habitats and to increase public access opportunity, including new trails and boardwalks and nature observation platforms. I have a couple of people here to testify and can answer to your questions. Again, is Mr. Don Ernesto from Audubon, Minnesota, and also my good friend, also member of Friends of Henry Park, who's a neighbor to this regional park, Mr. Tom Diamond.
Who wants to go first?
We'll go first. Tom Diamond. Didn't figure you all wanted it, but this is the document, the study that was done. It's a two-year planning process that's been done on the river corridor, including Pig's Eye Lake. And now we're moving towards the pre-design portion of the plan.
Senator Herr, this is in color.
Yes, it is in color. I have a black and white version, but last time I heard that you have better chance of getting the bonding if you have color. So.
Go ahead, Mr. Diamond.
Thank you.
It's an inside joke on the committee here, so go ahead.
The park is a 1,600-acre park in the middle of the city, part of the regional park system. It's... also includes the site of the historic Native American community, Kaposia Village, and also is the site of the first settlement of St. Paul. It includes not just being a part of the critical area, the state critical area, but it also includes the state scientific and natural area, the Heron and Egad Rookery, which is one of the largest Heron and Egad Rookeries this far north in the United States. And so there's wonderful assets to it, but one of the challenges that we have is it's virtually inaccessible. So one of the key parts about this plan is to provide access to this park. There'll be a north access and there'll be a south access into the park. The north access, I'll do the first south access for easier. That's a pedestrian, a bike, and hiking trail that will access the south end. It'll have to go over Highway 61 from the Mississippi River Trail and over the railroad tracks. There's the CP and the BN's mainline tracks there and access the park. On the north end access, it will be a trail and it will be a parkway access to the park. And it's tied into the regional headquarters for the DNR there, where and there's a lot of moving parts in this. The MnDOT's involved in some of this. The railroads are involved. The DNR is involved. And this one will have there'll be a new access for the road, improving the access for the DNR headquarters, the regional headquarters, and then providing access into the park. So this would be to help provide the pre-design, design funding to work through all the parts that have to be worked through and getting this plan going.
Mr. Arnosti.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Arnosti. I represent Audubon members across the state, but particularly for this bill, I'm representing the members of the St. Paul Audubon chapter, which is 2,300 citizens who live in the East Metro area. And as Mr. Diamond mentioned, this is a very significant natural resource asset that is very difficult to access from land. It is possible by boat, but it's very difficult from land, and most people do not have a boat on the river in this area. There's tremendous bird and wildlife activity in this area, and it's very attractive for people to come down and view the eagles and, as Mr. Diamond mentioned, the heron colony, which is part of a scientific and natural area. It's an area where waterfowl congregate in the fall and are also breeding throughout the spring breeding year. This area has significant water quality problems as well, and part of the plan is to help improve those water quality problems and reduce the toxic loading of the Mississippi further down by creating some artificial islands in the middle of Pig's Eye Lake to break up what's called wind fetch, which is just the windy stretch of the waves that build up across a big lake. And because Pig's Eye Lake is a very shallow part of the backwaters of the river, 6 to 8 feet deep, there's a lot of re-stirring of the bottom sediment that has a lot of the nasty chemicals and off byproducts of 150 years of dumping material in a old dump that has been reclaimed at the north end of the lake. So there's a very good water quality, human health, and wildlife health reason that it's important to get some of these islands in there to reduce the stirring of the sediment and allow them to lay at rest at the bottom of the lake.
And Mr. Ernest, did anybody talk about how you make those islands?
Yeah. There have been some proposals. There's been a very innovative proposal that's been looked at to have actually a floating island as a means to not disturb the bottom sediments. Again, the focus is just to reduce the large waves that come in these. And so there are proposals that are going to be looked at as part of the planning process to do it in perhaps some innovative ways to keep those sediments undisturbed.
If I could add to that.
Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Chair, the Corps of Engineers also did some preliminary looking at this because they have a program where they do some restoration along the waterway. And they've done some preliminary look at it, and they've had some ideas. And through the planning process that we just went through, as I say, it was a two-year planning process, further developed some of those ideas. But now we're looking to do more of the pre-design and design work to get into more of the specifics.
Good. Any other? Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you talk about floating islands and creating islands in the middle of a waterway like this, my one question is, do you have a no-wake zone in there for motorized boats? Has that been considered? And, Mr. Chair, I just question the amendment, but is this not in the city of St. Paul? It is, isn't it?
It is in the city of St. Paul.
Yeah, and still
inside
the county of Ramsey.
In the Ramsey County
certainly,
as well.
Certainly. So I guess the question is, Is this the beginning of a very large process, possibly, of expending a lot of dollars on creating islands and whatnot?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, two things. One is we didn't have a chance to talk on the amendment, and I'll just quickly address that. There's a number of different players, as I said, with this, and the plan has been done by the city. The city actually has 1,200 acres of this, and the county administers 400 acres of this process. Actually, where the trails come in are on the city's property, so actually the amendment, we can correct that later, but really doesn't fit for that a portion of it. Having said that, again, the specific design about the access or the islands, we haven't been able to get to that because we need that pre-design and design money to get through the finer definition of how these should be done. The county, let me jump back to the bridge from the DNR. DNR has met with the county's road people, public works people, have met with the city's public works people and parks people from the city and the county. And so all have been involved in that planning process, but they need the resources to further define how best to accomplish those goals.
Just a follow-up question, if I could. Senator, I know the trail area there because I walked that trail, have for the last 5 years I've been here. But this body, born in 1952, can only take so much. So I only go to the, I think it is the scrap metal yard there. So that trail does not go beyond that. Is that correct?
Well,
so I can say at least say that I go all the way to the end of the trail.
I think once. Mr. Diamond would know a little bit more because I tried to get in there myself and I drove through. I got lost. So I think having a multiple assets would be wonderful.
Mr. Diamond. It's like a beautiful area.
Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I can actually get you a map of the plan of the preliminary plan for how those connections would be done. Right now, the trail does not continue into there. If you know the area, you can go through an area across some railroad tracks and along the edge of a road next to a railroad tracks, and you can actually physically get in there. Most people don't know how to do it, and it's not advised because it's a little hazardous at this
point
in time.
A little traffic dodging back and forth?
A little traffic dodging, yes.
I guess I understand now. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I also have a few constituents here as well, and perhaps they might want to say a few words to support this project.
Thank you,
Tracy. Yep, Tracy Sy.
Welcome. Just say your name for the record, please.
Sure. My name's Tracy Sides, and I live and work on the east side of St. Paul, but I have lived in the metro area, various parts of Minneapolis and St. Paul, for over 20 years, and am an avid bicyclist and bike the trails along that area and throughout the Twin Cities, both trails and on the roads safely, and I signal. But I just wanted to voice a lot of support for this proposal, and coming both from my own selfish desire to see this happen, but also because I regularly run into people along those trails. Again, not literally. I encounter them, and they're from all over the country. I mean, the Twin Cities is the highest-ranked bicycle city in the nation. And so I think, promoting this for the health of our people, but also as an igniter for some of the economic activity around hospitality, and people often will bike out of downtown, and we just have tons and tons of trails, and I think this is a wonderful thing.
Thank you. What was that statistic we had the other day? $2.94 of health care costs for every what? Every mile? Every dollar? Every dollar of what? Spent on trails. There we go. So there you go. So
it decreases
So you must be healthy. So you're saving $2.94 on every.
I'm trying to do my part.
Every single time you ride. Okay, thank you. Any questions of the witness? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add a little humor. Last time we listened to a presentation about the two harbors and also Lake Wobegon, and I think this project is up to par with that as well, and it costs less, being that it's Pig Eyes, and Pig Eyes is the moniker of the first settler in St. Paul.
Oh, that's how we got the name.
In addition to being a beer company's name, but also I think it's Mr. Pier.
Call it, though. Call it.
Where is the brewery?
I think it's
not the West 7th Street Brewery, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that is the brewery.
It used to be.
Do we not have, we don't have Pig's Eye anymore beer, is that right? Or do we still have it?
The company's still around.
Okay. Oh, no, it's good. Okay. Any further comments or questions of Senator Hurst? Okay, thank you, Senator Hurst. So we'll lay Senate File 142 over for possible inclusion in the recommendation to the Bonding Committee. Senator Westrum.
Thank you.
I gotta get going.
Great. She's probably dodged me a couple times.
Senator Westrum, which one would you like to do first?
You know, Mr. Chair, if we could do the second one first, Morris.
Senate File 1411. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the bill in front of you today is dealing with an energy efficiency project and a request for the City of Morris in conjunction with ag processing. We have an ethanol plant, Denco number 2 ethanol plant that is in the City of Morris, provides 34 jobs and about 80 to 100 secondary jobs or supportive jobs for other companies that support this ag processing in our city. This bill would ask for dollars that would contribute half-to-half, one-to-one with non-public match dollars that the investors and others in the plant and the city are willing to put up to help bring forth some energy savings, energy efficiencies, and new innovative projects to recapture heat in a existing ag processing plant. And so with that, I'll let Mick Miller explain a little bit more about the proposal and open it up for questions, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mick Miller, General Manager for Denco 2, the ethanol processing facility in Morris. Today I bring apologies from the City Manager, Blaine Hill, who was not able to make it down here today, and ask that I sit in and provide information to educate you all on what's being proposed. Our ethanol plant in Morris is a very vital part of the community. It's the first dry mill ethanol plant ever in the state of Minnesota, and has had a long-standing relationship with the city and also with the University of Minnesota Morris. We provide a lot of technical expertise back and forth between the university, and are actually currently working on some enzyme development for future phases of biofuels. But more importantly, our facility has two main issues, which are have created troublesome for us. One being water. In our local area, Morris has just terrible, terrible groundwater. We physically cannot turn our wells on and lay a garden hose down and discharge that water. The PCA will not allow that. So our water quality standards are greater than what basically we're able to pull out of the ground and drink from a, you know, water in versus discharge. Second phase, this project is to address an energy problem with our facility. Again, being it's the oldest plant in Minnesota. It is a very good, sound, structurally facility, but the new plants in today's environment that we're competing against have a little bit different integration with how they're processing the corn into biofuels, and we need to spend about $2.5 million to upgrade our facility to bring our energy consumption down. Most plants in today's environment use about 28,000 BTUs of energy to produce a gallon of biofuels. Our facility uses about 35,000 to 36,000. So this technology and process will bring us down to that level and ultimately help us compete long term. And again, it's about the ethanol facility and 34 jobs that are very important to our local community.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Senator Westrom, any final comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll mimic Senator Sieben, and you asked if we'd like it in the omnibus bill or on its own, and Mr. Chair, we would like this in the omnibus bill.
And just because we've been doing bonding all day, I just want everybody to understand this isn't a bonding request. This is a request from the general fund. So,
sure.
So this is cash. So, okay. I appreciate that, Senator Westrom. And so then I'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you,
okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senate File 1411 is laid over. Okay. Senate File 1429, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to be brief, but to the point, another opportunity of $2.84 savings of health.
94.
294.
294, yes.
Mr. Chair, we've handed out some maps of a proposed trail that our county engineer, Grant County, in Grant County, has drawn up. They tell me it's in color, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it is, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of colors here. Senator,
could you explain the green color on the map?
Mr. Chair, and there's also included in there a letter from Greg Jacobson, our Public Works director in Elba Lake. Elba Lake is where I live. In Senate District 12, and a project that's been talked about off and on for several years, but there is now a local initiative and movement and a fire in the belly to help construct part of a phase of a longer trail to connect to the Central Lakes Trail, which is on the west end of Central Lakes Trail. At the east end in my district is Lake Wobegon Trail, and so just to give you that reference, that runs from St. Joseph down by St. Cloud all the way up to Fergus Falls through Sauk Center, Alexandria, and Evansville, Ashby, and up to Fergus Falls. This trail would not connect to that, but the future plan would be to connect to that. Greg lays out the cost, and Mr. Chair, at some point I'd like if we could just amend a number into the blank line, but I've asked staff to get an oral amendment ready. I'll finish quickly, and maybe that's a good time to do it. What this trail would do is connect from the city of Elba Lake on the east side out to a city campground that they have developed in the last 15 to 20 years. It has revolutionized a local beach, a local park, and this lake, Pomme de Terre Lake, which is the north end of the Pomme de Terre River that runs down under the Minnesota River. But they have a campground and just a public beach area, and on weekends they have generally 200 to 300 campers out in that area. They've grown to, and on holiday weekends it's up to 500 campers at times. Beyond that is a golf course another couple of miles away, and then around the other side of the lake is another public beach. And then the idea, the reason I mentioned those two areas, they are not part of this proposal, but that would be a future connection on the way to the Central Lakes Trail that we would ultimately want to connect to. And so this would be the first leg in the phase from Elba Lake along this State Highway 79 out to the campground area, about 4.1 miles. The city has been in discussions, and the county been in discussions with MnDOT, and generally they're in agreement that there would be enough right-of-way from MnDOT, and MnDOT assuming they would approve the use, and it sounds like they're working together on this and think it would be a possible and a viable project, but they would be able to keep the cost of this trail down because of the limited need of acquiring easements or land acquisition. There is a bridge crossing the river. Initially, that was a concern. The latest verdict or thought on that is discussing with MnDOT is the bridge that they put in over the river, the culvert, is likely wide enough to accommodate for a trail on the north side of the bridge and a guardrail that MnDOT would install and potentially or allow to be installed as part of the trail and the safety for the pedestrians crossing the bridge. And so the hope is not to have to have a separate bridge crossing the river, and right now it looks like they would not need that. But this would get us moving down the road and get the first phase of this trail built into a area that would be highly used with the campground and the local residents going back and forth.
Thank you, Senator Westrom. Do you have a number? I see it says $500,000 in the letter from Mr. Jacobson. Is that the number that you want in the?
That is. I was actually thinking it was said $550,000, but I might have misread it. That's the number I would like to.
Okay, so Senator Westrom moves to insert on line 1.6 $500,000 after the dollar sign. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. And Senator Westrom, this is money that looks like it comes from the Parks and Trails Fund. Do you want to leave it there, or would you prefer it come from bonding?
You know, Mr. Chairman, if bonding is more likely, then I would prefer bonding.
just tell me, because we can even leave it like this, or we can amend it to go for bonding.
Would Mr. Chairman, would your suggestion be if we amended to bonding, we would at least send it out as part of a recommendation?
Senator Westrom, we have heard over $500 million in bonding requests, just so you know. And so I don't know. You're going to have to make the call yourself.
I think we'll leave it at this part, Mr. Chair, and I guess that's the DNR Trails Fund is probably where we would try to get funding from as well otherwise.
Okay. Then are there any comments or questions of Senator Westrom?
Mr. Chair, so is it the Senator Westrom? Were you wanting to include this in the bonding bill, the plain bonding bill, as well as Parks and Trails? I know a lot of requests are probably going to go for both.
Go for both
areas.
So, well, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if I'll follow your lead, and if perhaps you're suggesting maybe we should send it for bonding, and there'd be no harm in doing that.
It's up to you. I know the bonding chair has asked if we can get some of the bonding requests for trails into Parks and Trails funds. So it's six of one, half a dozen the other here. But if you want me to amend it to bond or leave it the way it is, and
let's go for bonding, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, then
I'm reading tea leaves here, Mr. Chairman.
I don't know what their tea leaves say, to tell you the truth, but
my sight isn't always so good.
It's foresight that we're worried about.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we need an amendment, or do we just lay it over for possible inclusion?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think it would take a significant amendment to change this to a bonding bill. I think at this point, if you're just sending a list over, you can just lay this over for possible inclusion, and it would be on a list that would be sent over.
So you might get on two lists, so that's probably what you want to do, Senator.
That does sound good.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the recommendation of the bonding committee. So. Okay. And that concludes the bonding bills that I think we're going to hear for this session. And so that's nice to have that all done. I'm not sure, staff, when are we going to be ready with an omnibus bill? Do we know when that's going to be?
A couple of weeks.
So we're going to roll it out, is it? Huh?
Later this week.
So as we're preparing for an omnibus bill, it'll be later this week. So I don't know if that's Wednesday or Thursday. And my intent is to have a bill for the committee and have the staff explain it to the committee and then lay it over for voting on for the next day. So we'll have two hearings, or maybe three, because I think we can actually get it out of here on Monday the 15th if we want to, because we're scheduled to be in finance on the 17th. So,
Mr. Chair, is there a floor session on Tuesday?
I don't know.
Usually Monday.
So if there's
because the only issue is, Mr. Chair, is if you want to have a division bill introduced and then sent to finance, it has to be introduced a day before they hear it.
I thought we were doing it the other way. I thought we were.
We can do either way.
I thought we were sending it from here to finance, and then they were.
Either way, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well,
introduce a skeleton bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, some way, somehow, we're going to get this out of here, and hopefully, we can get it out by Friday. If we can't, we'll do it on Monday. So, at any rate, stay tuned, and I'll be in touch with everybody on the committee. So, thank you, everybody, and meeting adjourned.